Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Welcome to our weekend preview show. Neil Atkinson, Rob Gutman, Paul Dehaney and Mo Stewart with you for the next hour or so. There in the studio over the phone, Steve Armstrong, Steve Goldsmith and Robbie Scotcher. It's longer than an hour. I've already done the calls. We have a big chat, me and Steve Armstrong, about ticketing. It gets very interesting indeed. That's to come, though. Before then, though, we're actually going to start with Spurs this week. We've got Paul Dehaney with us, and I'm very, very pleased to have Paul Dehaney before Liverpool play Spurs this weekend. And Paul, Spurs are still turning the results out. It's all there for them, and it's an interesting comparison with last season, really, which was it was at this period last season, for the 2 or 3 months that precede right now, where Spurs made all the hay. It's where they got all the points on the board before having a slight decline and had a bit of a slow start. It's interesting how that pattern's replicated itself. It suggested something in the manager's training, for one.
I don't know. I think that definitely the winter period has seen... the last few years, it seems to be a pattern that we've, any ground that we've lost, we've tended to make up over that kind of end of December, sort of February period, through to about now, really. But we did kick on last year, and I think the Man City away game around this time was the time when people were like, oh, okay, Spurs can be in this. And I think it's a kind of a similar game, in a sense, for us, that it could define whether we can still... Now, I'm not saying for 1 minute we can catch Chelsea, but I think if we were to lose or draw against Liverpool, I think that then you're saying, right, we're thinking about we're playing for second, third or fourth, as opposed to if we can win, that keeps the pressure on Chelsea somewhat. But it's, for me, it's always a difficult game at Liverpool to call, you know. Particularly in the last few years, there's been... If you're going to ask me for a prediction later, I've got no idea. You could be 0-0, 1-1, 0-3, 3-0. You know, I really haven't got an idea. I just think that are we playing you at the wrong time again when you really need a result? And that's my my.
Well, it's one of the two, isn't it, Neil? It's one of the two that you're playing. It's either the best time because you're going to get this demoralised slightly. The deflated version of Liverpool, or you can get the defiant Liverpool that tends to find itself in these bigger games. I totally agree with you. I'm coming from the other side of the opposite side of the fence. I haven't got a clue which way this goes. And I've heard Liverpool fans this week go, oh, we'll turn up for this and it'll be just like us. And I go, I wouldn't even be confident about that. It'd be just like us to be totally unpredictable, but who knows?
I think it's, before we get onto that Liverpool aspect, it's interesting how much the game's in everyone's head. But the other thing that I've seen through watching Spurs this season is the importance of Kane. And I think it's now actually got to the point where it's not being talked about enough. Paul, I'd probably argue that he's probably the individual Premier League footballer worth the most points to his team. I think in terms of how better defined Spurs are when he played. I mean, we talked a lot about Liverpool missing Mane, but I actually think that not just because of his own ability, but because of what he brings everybody else. If you take him out of that Spurs lineup, the drop-off's absolutely huge. And he's also a joy to watch in many senses, because it's hard to say what he's brilliant at, but it's apart from scoring goals. But he's so good at so many aspects of the game. He doesn't have blistering pace.
I think you'd probably all agree that maybe this time last season, you probably looked at Kane as just someone who puts the ball in the back of the net, which isn't a bad habit to have, but not really much else than that. But I think you see in this year, there's so much more facets to his game. I think Chelsea at home stands out to me, where he didn't score... and he didn't play particularly well in the game, but he did enough to occupy, running the channels, just doing the dirty work. He's good at linking play. There's not really anything he can't do. And I think that people have kind of starting to see the value of that now, and that he's not just a one-trick pony as a striker.
I think the mental side of his game is underrated as well, because, I mean, let's face it, he had a really bad summer where he was getting pelters from all directions. He's the guy who Spurs look to more than anyone. If it's not happening, everyone's looking, come on, Harry, get us a goal. His head never drops. He'll miss 15 chances in the game and score the 16th and win the game.
Yeah.
And I think that that's something really important to the rest. Like you say, in terms of making the rest of the team play better, Neil, I think that's a really good part of it. However, I was doing some stats looking, as I do sometimes in preparation for the show, and I was interested about your line about Kane being the most important person to the team. There was an article in The Guardian recently about the percentage of each player's who has the most goals and assists out of the goals that they scored. Kane's not even in the top 10.
Mm. Really?
Yeah.
Across the league.
Yeah. Oh. It's Matt, and I was astounded because I, like you, I thought if he doesn't score, they don't score. But I looked at it, and the other thing that's kind of Spurs' go-to when Kane's not scoring.
You've got Dele Alli.
Set pieces, though. What you've got that we haven't got at the moment is a couple of guys who are reliable with crossing the ball into dangerous areas. And when you've got a set piece, you've got three or four defenders who are good at heading the ball into the net. Mm. And that's a good fullback to have.
And you know what's amazing to me about Harry Kane is, if you put the word Harry Kane into my mind, I'm not thinking about him every day, I'm a Liverpool fan, but it's, oh yeah, Harry Kane, I wonder if he's really very good. And then you go, hang on, this is the third season he's scored. When are we actually going to say this is a world-class striker? When are we going to say if Man U should come in for him in the summer, they should pay 80 million for him? Mm. You know, that seems to not be...
He's a self-deprecating guy, though, isn't he? Mm. Well, he's not the one who's going to be shouting about how great he is. And sometimes we miss those guys because the people who are shouting are, you know, putting emojis on their...
I think what summed it up to me with his mentality, I was reading an interview the other day, and he was saying that during a game, if he misses a chance or if a striker hurts him, he'll run away as if he's not hurt, or if he's angry, he won't react. Mm-hmm. He'll keep it inside and just... He doesn't want to give anyone any advantage or to think that he's mentally weak in any way. So I think he's got this real level-headedness about him, whether he's scoring 10 goals in 10 games or 1 in 10, you know.
This level-headedness, I think, and Rob, I think this is part of the wider sort of... Not is he any good, because he's clearly very good, but the as Mo sort of saying, not really shouting it from the rooftops, I think that there appears to be a real work ethic around his own game, his own ways in which he can improve, how can he add more. Mm. And that's what I think you see in this season from him, is that it's so there's a generosity of spirit about it which you don't get from a lot of number nines. You get the impression he sees himself as very much a cog in this. He reminds me, you know, there's certain sort of old style strikers he reminds me of, whereas I keep saying it's not like he sticks it in the back of the net, and that's obviously a massive strength, but it isn't as though he hasn't got Sanchez's ability as an example on the one hand, but on the other hand he's remarkably, unbelievably effective, and you get the impression he's just working all the time on ways to become more and more and more effective.
Yes, but the strange thing about him, yes, he does feel like a composite team player, the complete team player. But on the other hand, if you watch him closely, the amount of shots he gets away, he's, you know, you can almost feel sorry for Daniel Sturridge. Daniel Sturridge gets trouble in his pomp anyway, gets shots away, and people look at his swagger and his surly look on his face and go, Daniel Sturridge, all about himself. Harry Kane, quietly, he scores goals for a reason, because he buys a ticket for that, for the proverbial.
Definitely.
That's why he scores goals. But yeah, hidden within that modesty, I think, is a very, very focused goal getter. Mm-hmm. But your point about calling him an old world striker, in a sense, I kind of think I default to that thinking because I can't think who the hell he's like now. But he's not actually like the old guys, the old world strikers I grew up with either. He's very much a unique kind of attacking player. Yeah.
And he's one of those whose his reaction to any setback is to work harder. And I think those are the kind of attributes that can see him eventually be classed as a world-class player and go on for years and years. Because the same thing people used to say about Cristiano Ronaldo, isn't it? Is that that's what his relentlessness in trying to improve day in,
and
day out.
And Frank Lampard, who's just retired.
Exactly.
As well.
And these are the kind of guys who we're going to remember as greats of our game. In
and who it is,
time.
Vieri. That's who we've compared him to before.
Christian Vieri.
That one. It's not a bad one. It's a good one.
Yeah. He's ably supported, though. Like, I was
going to say, who else should play him well?
Yeah, I would say that Harry Kane really just... He's really just an example of a lot of the players who, and that Pochettino has put his touch on and made them better players. And sort of, I saw an interview with Danny Rose the other day, and he was saying, you know, Danny Rose was getting booed by the Spurs fans a couple of years ago, and they never ever saw him being the left back he is today. But he said that Pochettino showed him videos, gave him ways of how to defend properly and how to attack properly and work on his game. And I think that if the player's willing to listen, then Pochettino's willing to put in the time. And we've seen the benefit of that with Rose, we've seen it with Dembele.
Kyle Walker, surely, as well.
Kyle Walker, who was, you know, an accident waiting to happen. Great going forward, but defensively, I mean, you've seen it a couple of times in 2-3-2 defeats in a row we had at Anfield, where we played really well, but Walker sort of self-imploded in both of those games.
And White Hart Lane when we won 5-0.
Awful. So I think that what he's done is we've always had talented players, but the application has never been what it should be in terms of we had a soft underbelly. We knew that, you know, we went down, we said it a couple of weeks ago, 2-0 down at Man City on the rack. We'd have got buried 5 or 6, you know, in the old days. Mm-hmm. But this Tottenham team's made of sterner stuff, which gives me the most pleasure at the moment more than anything.
Is you keep mentioning the manager there, he's obviously so central to everything that's going on. He also appears to be a man who's enjoying himself. There was rumours around this time last season linking him to United, all this sort of stuff. It's very difficult now to envisage him not being at Tottenham for the next two seasons, possibly three. Things can move fast in world football. You never know. It might be that Barcelona decide, well, we want this guy, and then he's got a big decision to make. But what I mean by that is you look at the rest of the top, the other sides in the top six, they all look relatively settled with the manager, apart from maybe Wenger at Arsenal, and that's not going to happen. Mm. So, you know, you don't see him moving to Bayern Munich. It looks to me as though Pochettino's going to be Spurs manager.
One thing that gives me a bit of... hope and it for some sort of mid to long term stability is the fact of this new stadium. I think it's such a catalyst in terms of the manager and players all wanting to be involved in this massive project, you know. And I think
arrive in triumph at it.
Yeah, basically, at least be the ones that are there. Well, you know, Pochettino, I'm sure, is looking at that and thinking, I want to be the manager. And I like what he said the other day, which was, you know, we're not panicking at the moment. We're building a team so that when we move into this stadium, we'll be able to buy the players that, you know, similar to what Arsenal said, actually, but I actually believe it in this case. And I think that we've already got a lot of things in place. It's not like we have to rip up the canvas and start again when we move into the stadium. A bit like West Ham, we're almost like, you know, they didn't have that team to move into that stadium that where you think, all right, they're going to move on.
I think as well, I mean, the Olympic Stadium's not exactly far from Upton Park, but there is a whole community of shops and that whole area around the stadium which kind of went dormant, and Spurs won't have that problem because it's literally on the doorstep.
Literally next door, nothing changed. I mean, there are obviously the usual uproar with a lot of shops that have been there for years. That, you know, I know the businesses that I used to go to when I was young, but they're doing their best to relocate that. But the key is keeping that ground in that community is going to be so important.
That area of London needed regenerating. I hope it's a catalyst for that. Do you expect that?
Seen it. I go back every month or so when I have meetings there, and my mum still lives in Tottenham, so I'll stay over at hers while I'll have meetings in London. So I've seen the ground. And when I went the last time, it was quite scary because it was the first time I actually thought, wow, this is the ground. You know, the whole bottom tier is kind of taking shape. They've starting to work on the neck, and you can see the ground taking shape, and it's quite exciting now. I never thought I'd see it in my lifetime, and let's hope I still make it to see it.
The weekend then, which could finish it off. Another time you're at Anfield and it's all over the place. I mean, it is almost certainly, given what I'm asking you, Paul, is we've seen how sides in the bottom half of the table have set up against Liverpool and had success. We've seen that they sit deep, just frustrate them, looked at them on the break and get something from set pieces. I'm asking you as a Spurs supporter, do you think that's something that Spurs would want to do, something that Spurs can do? Because I think that this manager, he spent the whole season saying this is the way we play our football, boys. I think it's difficult to imagine him saying, but we're going to change all that for this one at Anfield.
It's not in our makeup to, with this team, I think Pochettino actually sets out teams to win a game, whoever we're playing, you know. And, you know, in the first kind of season, it was to our detriment in a way because we were going at teams really that we really couldn't really stand toe-to-toe with and, you know, might have ended up coming unstuck. But I think nowadays, you know, we've been to Arsenal away, Chelsea away. We've probably played, I think this might be our last big away game out of all the top teams, and we lost narrowly at United and Chelsea and drew probably most of the others. But I never feel that we go out there to... I feel we'll take the game to you, and I think we'll have a lot of possession.
Will you defend relatively high up the pitch?
We do. I don't think we're set up to just sit back and let you... The only way we're going to sit back and let you come at us is if you come at us, basically. Do you know what I mean? Is what Man City done. They had sort of 6 or 7 attack-minded players and just came at us and we couldn't handle it. That's a worry, but I don't know if we're going to allow that to happen, particularly in the first half.
Is there any particular team news to watch out for? As it looks to me like Vertonghen's not going to make it.
Rose
won't make it.
Vertonghen won't make it. Kieran Tripp is back in the squad after an injury, but obviously Walker's going to start. Ben Davis will start at left back, and Eric Dier will probably start alongside
Alderweireld.
Dier's actually really come back into form. He took a few games to get back into that centre-back position, but last two games without Rose and Vertonghen, two clean sheets, you know. So, again, just quietly, I think I've said it on numerous occasions, I think with Tottenham and Liverpool in particular, it's about systems, not players. Obviously, you guys probably won't agree with that because of the way things have been going recently. But I think if you look at it over Klopp's reign, you know, when you look at people like Sturridge and stuff like that, it's about systems and not players.
I agree. And I think that's probably why I don't expect Spurs to sit back the way some other teams have, because essentially the pressing game that we are still getting used to as a squad, Spurs are at least one season ahead of us at it. So they're going to think that they can do it better than us, to be honest with you. And one of our other issues recently has been the slow starts in games. Spurs will come out snapping into tackles. They'll be pressing us all high up at the pitch.
I think they will, Mo, and I think, but another reason for that is that Liverpool are a football team in dire need of a win. And that's the, you know, that Spurs know that Liverpool haven't been in great shape recently, quiet in the crowd, big first 20, exactly. Score early. You can take the football match away. You can at least feel as though you're taking the football match away with a strong start if you're Tottenham, Mo.
Big time. And I think a lot of us Liverpool fans are thinking, because it's a big game, we're going to be up for it. So we're kind of relying on the fact that we're going to be up for it and that this game is going to hopefully turn the season around. So if it is a slow start or a Spurs get an early goal and that goes against us, it's going to be tough. It's going to be tough. But
yeah, on the other side, though, you know, with a more pessimistic head on, please don't think for 1 minute. Please don't think for 1 minute that I think we're going to go there and win the game, you know, with ease. It's, you know, whatever way it happens, it's going to be, even if we do win, I feel that it's going to have to be a hard-earned win. And I think that Liverpool are a wounded animal at the moment, and that always worries me.
It's going to be a strong Liverpool team. That's the one thing. I mean, we went to Hull last weekend going, thank God we've got our first 11 more or less back, and it just didn't happen.
No.
But you kind of think that collection, that ideal 11 we have, and there's an argument about Wijnaldum and Emre Can. Actually, there's not much of an argument. Wijnaldum surely comes back in for Emre Can, but that best 11 Liverpool can put out and probably will put out is a strong collection of footballers. And you think there is a degree to which, although I'm very depressed and pessimistic at the moment, you think it has to click again soon unless we have another injury crisis. Mane, Coutinho, Firmino is formidable. Jordan Henderson is a brilliant anchor man, and Adam Lallana and Wijnaldum carry the ball through midfield. They played it at an exceptionally high level. Unless their legs have all gone and they're going to be rewriting sports science books on this season, at some point this Liverpool team does have to click into gear.
Well, this game, Rob, is reminiscent of, you know, there was the game prior to when Liverpool played Spurs early in the season away from home. Liverpool went to Burnley, got beat 2-0, and at times looked like they could barely trap it. Liverpool have gone to Hull, got beat 2-0, looked like they could barely trap it.
Yeah.
And in one occasion for Adam Lallana, quite embarrassingly, couldn't. There is, you know, it's reminiscent, to be honest with you. It does feel as though it's there for this Liverpool side. I think the only question now is that where in many Liverpool supporters' heads, and maybe in the Liverpool players' heads, and this is why it's such an interesting game, I think, this weekend, almost Leicester feels like this bigger challenge now, because we know what Leicester are going to do, whereas you have seen Liverpool do well in these games. You're saying it earlier on. It doesn't mean they're necessarily going to turn up, but you are thinking to yourself, listen, if it is a ding-dong game of football, you're almost more confident of Liverpool getting a result than you would be conceivably at the moment if it was a side that was just going to sit deep.
Yes, but I also think we kid ourselves with that a little bit, because it's about expectation.
And at some point you're going to lose one of these games against the top six.
Exactly. And let's face it, we come out of Chelsea with a draw, but it's a home draw. But because it's Chelsea, we're delighted and go, that's a good result. If you get a draw at Hull, you're suicidal, but I'm afraid the points are the same. So I would rather be facing Leicester away tomorrow than Tottenham at home. There's no getting away from that. I take your point. Yes, it feels like Liverpool are more set up to dress to impress against a team like Tottenham than they are Leicester. It almost feels like we can't win against Leicester, and that somehow we just have to grind out a result.
For me, I think the only difference between the two games is, unless we do something amazing and absolutely hammer Spurs, there's not really much we can take from this game going forward. This game is not going to decide if we're going to be all right for the rest of the season. That's going to be the Leicester game. So I think a good performance in this game, as vital as it is that we get,
we'd all write it off in our heads in a weird way. We beat Spurs, a side who was second place in the table, who were doing all this, Mo. Liverpool beat them, they beat them 3-1, they play well. Everyone will say, that's great, but let's see what happens next.
Exactly.
Which is really weird.
It is, it's just the way we are.
Yeah, but I was thinking about this morning, I was thinking, Chelsea's record against the other protagonists, it's actually quite poor. They've lost to Arsenal, they've lost to Tottenham, they've lost to Liverpool.
They were lucky to beat City.
Lucky to beat City. So everybody always used to say, oh, if you win all, you know, against the top sides and showing the mini league table and all that stuff. And I think you lot will probably be top on
it. We are, yeah, we are.
So mad. It's actually the other games.
They've
that
got
are the
2 points against
ones,
the bottom,
you know?
10. Yeah. 2 points. Yeah. That's no mistakes.
Yeah, yeah. So, nice. You know, there you go.
On this then. The manager's making noises, Robert, and making changes. That they've been what's come out straight away, that he feels as though he might have to be a bit ruthless going into this one. How ruthless do you think he can get away with? Because what fascinates me, again, is that this isn't the Leicester game when he might think, you know what, I'll throw it out and I'll put two up front or something like that. This is against a side where he played them once already this season, got a 1-1, where Liverpool, for an hour, certainly deserved all 3 points, where he's seen how we can set up against these sides. So to make these noises like, I'm going to be ruthless with these lads now, before a game like this one, when you think he'd want to go with the tried and trusted, it's interesting.
It's where he can be ruthless. I think he probably wants to put them on their toes in making that statement. Definitely. And make a few of them go, oh, thank God, I thought I was for the chop there, and I've made it, and I've got one last chance. So I think there's a degree of psychology in him making that kind of statement. But let's take it at face value. Where he can be ruthless, I think a lot of us are looking with... looking intrigued at the right back position and seeing if Trent Alexander-Arnold will come in for Klein. Trent was impressive against Spurs, funnily enough, in the under-23 game at Anfield just under a week ago. I think he wins a penalty and an assist. He gives the complete Trent performance. Fantastic delivery from right-hand side. Mm-hmm. And with teams that want us, if we do force them deep, he could be a real asset for us. I'd worry about him on the counter with Spurs' assets, but
I still find it hard to think that Trent is a better right back right now than Nathaniel Klein. Nathaniel Klein's had a couple of bad games. He's still been arguably one of our most consistent players these last 10 years.
Look, if we're on form, yeah. But I'm talking in the context of a shake-up here.
Okay.
In the context of a shake-up, and where you go, I've almost got to make three changes to change the mindset. Because I think managers do get into that. Mm-hmm. That let's stop the rot. Let's call it a new team. So it's almost a symbolic set of changes. So Nathaniel's at risk. I'd say Emre Can is obviously a risk for Wijnaldum. I have a sneaking suspicion. It's two wild cards who could be a risk, but not both would drop out. One of Firmino and Lallana, if he wanted to do something slightly crazy, I think. I'm not quite sure what he'd do, but I could see something like that, because Firmino looks like he's leggy. Lallana not quite there since he's come back from a couple of injuries, not scored in a while, was poor at Bournemouth last weekend. He's not going to sacrifice Coutinho, and he's not going to sacrifice Mane or Henderson either.
See...
Goalkeeper.
Yeah, him. He could go. Yeah.
I think most of us would probably agree that if Karius played from now to the end of the season, just so we get a better idea if he's going to be the guy who we think he could be or if he's not. So we know if we need to buy one or two in the summer, basically. I think that's where a lot of people could see it, not necessarily where Klopp sees it. But I think this whole shake-up thing is rather interesting, because if he does shake it up, it will be almost a guide to where he thinks the team's going wrong. Because if he does get rid of Klein or change a couple in the back four, then he's obviously thinking the defence is the biggest problem. If he brings out one of our star attackers, he's thinking, well, maybe our front four is not quite as all-conquering as it has been. Personally, the way he's been talking, I wouldn't be surprised if it's Henderson. And the fact that the shake-up is the fact that it's the captain. And we maybe start looking at...
You wouldn't be surprised. I'd be shocked.
Well, I mean, I'm not saying that he should be dropped. I'm just saying that he's someone who's he's managing an injury, again, as he was towards the end of last season. He's not been firing on all cylinders. I'd be happy to see him stay in the team. I can just see how that potentially could be a way to go. Maybe do...
Milner and Moreno.
Maybe bring Milner into midfield.
I'd be amazed if it's Henderson, and the reason why is because the extent of the fuss he goes to make of Henderson coming off the pitch against Chelsea. To sort of go from that, where he waits to give Henderson the big hug, points at him in front of all the supporters, to go from that to one game later to then go, you're the captain, but you're bombed out. I think it feels to me ballsy. As though it'd be huge. And yeah. Also the fact that, being fair to Henderson, I felt that there was basically two players who hit the heights of a 7 out of 10 against Hull. One was Henderson and the other one was Mane. And, you know, at least Mane was repeatedly having a go.
Yeah.
The rest of them I was looking at going, what are you all scared of, boys? Why aren't you doing what the manager looks like he's told you to do?
Again, I'm thinking from the same lines.
The idea
as
that
well,
he makes two big changes and everyone's going,
wow.
So yeah. are we saying that these changes would be based on the player's mentality, lack of form, as opposed to tactically changing?
Well, I don't know, because he changed it for United, and this is when I've got my next thing to note here, is that will there be a tactical diddle for Spurs? Because at United, he goes with what looked like much more of a 4-4-2 diamond from nowhere. I mean, he played in the League Cup, but from nowhere, suddenly Liverpool looked like they were doing this. So it wouldn't surprise me if he has got something sort of semi up his sleeve. And again, he almost feels, and this is the one which I think is interesting, he already knows Sunday, Monday last week, when all these noises about significant changes, he's thinking, well, I was going to change three of them anyway because I've got this thing lined up for what we're going to do when we face Spurs. Mm. So it wouldn't surprise me if he's riding two horses in some way.
I think he's definitely going to be looking at the fact that Tottenham's strongest point in the last sort of during this kind of 12 match unbeaten run has been the axis of Dembele and Wanyama, two absolute beasts in midfield. I mean, the amount of times they got the ball back against Middlesbrough last week when, you know, just hunting the ball down and aggressively winning it back. If you've got those two up against any two, against two, I fancy them, anyone in the league. But I've seen a couple of teams where they've played three in there to sort of, that then forces Ali to come back from that number 10 and it negates us going forward. Obviously, we're still holding our own, but, you know...
I think he'll be looking at the City hour. If I was the Liverpool manager, I'd be looking at the City hour. And I know what you said before, where you said they picked so many attacking players, and they did. But I'd be looking at the City hour, because I still can't work out if... You said before, Spurs, you know, they were just forced deep. I think that was... Maybe they were thinking a little bit, we might play a little deep at a different pace. You can't tell because of how much City, from minute one, just got on top of them and just made it so difficult to play. And I wonder if the Liverpool manager might be having a little look at that and thinking... Because what City did, which was really interesting, was they went... We're not going to out-scrap you.
Mm.
We can't. You're bigger lads. Mm. We're just going to find clever ways to outplay
you. Clever little small passes, you know, tricky. And they've got those type of players as well.
Yeah,
so have you guys.
It was back to Torre with Silva and De Bruyne in front.
Yeah,
was this idea of, and it, when you say before that maybe, you know, we might do something with the front three, I think one of the things you might do with the front three might be the idea of, I'm not playing Emre Can, I'm not playing Wijnaldum, I might just go Lallana and Coutinho and have the idea that Henderson, Lallana, Coutinho, and have these lads essentially just ping it round between themselves with three up front, Firmino coming and dropping in and standing on one of Wanyama and Dembele and saying, right lads, you've got to cope with all three of this. There's three of these lads all playing around your two, and if Ali wants to come deeper, then Henderson becomes an option, and I've got two up front who could well then become Mane and one of Sturridge and Origi. That wouldn't surprise me if that's what he ends up doing. I just wonder if this game just comes a bit too early, Rob, because that feels like a really ballsy move.
Yeah, I could see, yes, it does. I mean, I couldn't see a Sturridge starting. I could see a Origi being a wild card starter. But you know which I think he could do is he could switch both fullbacks with a view to getting 10 yards higher up the pitch. Because Milner and Klein, whatever they've done well this season, they've done loads well up to Christmas. They're that bit more conservative than, say, Trent and Moreno would be. Okay, there's a lot of it would be a risk that, because what you get coming back the other way is huge vulnerability with Moreno and Trent. But he could say, do you know what, we need to hit. If you want a quick start and you put pace, those two lads are quicker than Milner and Klein. And okay, and Trent's got better delivery, Moreno's got no delivery. There is that argument. But he will get beyond his opposite number, Moreno, which Milner doesn't really do enough. So that could be another way, Neil. He just goes both of those lads. That's about a move for pace.
I think you'll find that Spurs won't have as much on both flanks, because Ben Davis tends to be a little bit more conservative than what Rose, and less athletic, you know, for want of a better phrase. You know, he can't do...
Rose doesn't have to cover some ground.
Oh, my
He's a big miss, surely, for Spurs.
He is, particularly on that left side going forward. But what I've noticed is, in the last couple of games, is Davis has got to a certain point and then Son has been the one to take up that left-hand side. So, it's almost like a change in tactic. And having said that, against someone like Mane, do I really want my left-back you know, going too far forward. I probably want Davis to be a little bit more conservative in that. But what I am saying is it negates halfway, you know, the other side of our pitch. Mm. We've only got that one main attacking raider in Kyle Walker.
So we could essentially try to look to overload that one side of the pitch.
I'm giving away my tactics.
too much. So Jürgen's listening.
Let's
get your predictions insofar as they can be, because I'm expecting, if you ask me to do the odds, if you know what I mean, I think there's a 1 in 3 chance to win, it's a 1 in 3 for Liverpool, it's a 1 in 3 chance to defeat for Liverpool, and it's a 1 in 3 chance to draw. So Paul Dehaney.
Fence sitter extraordinaire, 1-1.
1-1. Mo?
I'm going to say two things. One, it definitely won't be 0-0. Two, whoever scores first wins.
Okay, Rob?
4-1 to Liverpool.
After all that.
Yes, Rob, that's what I like to hear.
After all that. Excellent stuff. All right, then. Earlier on, I spoke to Steve Armstrong, mentioned it before. We talked about ticketing for some time, and then we did talk a little bit about Manchester United. This is what he had to say. Joined now by Steve Armstrong, indeed, when talking about what the other side in the top six, as it is a top six this season, are doing. The Liverpool are doing the level best to make it a top five at the moment. Joined by Steve to talk about Manchester United. But before we get into what's happening on the pitch, there was a curious thing for Manchester United's ticketing arrangements at the weekend. And every side does their away tickets differently. But I think it's always worth keeping an eye on what Liverpool and United are doing, because that's the direction of travel normally, where Liverpool and United go in English football. Other sides look to follow. And United had a curious thing at Leicester, Steve.
Yeah, it was a bit odd. The thing, I mean, listen, I know I've kicked off about it a number of times, but I'm well aware of the positive reasons and what they're trying to achieve by doing it. But what was unique about the game at Leicester was, and I'll give you a bit of background just so that you guys can understand the sort of the way tickets are given at United. And we get on average, you're talking around the 2,000 to 2,500. So if you take Anfield, let's use that as an example, we'd get our allocation that you give to away fans there. United, for various reasons, extra segregation, I think it's around the 2,500. United would get something for a big game like Liverpool, probably something in the region of 8,000, 9,000, 10,000 applications. So you've kind of got like a 1 in 5, 1 in 6 chance of getting one. I know Liverpool have this sort of loyalty system where, you know, you get credits and all this kind of stuff. That doesn't apply at United. The way it works is they allocate a proportion to what they call the loyalty pot. And the loyalty pot sounds like a loyalty scheme, but it isn't. We've even managed to not get that right, because basically you get a point in your loyalty pot. If you're in the loyalty pot, you're in there because you've applied for every away game since Ron Atkinson was the manager.
Yeah.
I'm not in the loyalty pot because I once missed the deadline to apply for Exeter away in the replay by a minute. So I'm not in it. So I don't get the luxury of that. They have a higher success rate of getting tickets. Now, the loyalty pot in itself is flawed, because you get credit for applying to go to Goodison Park away, but you don't get any credit for going to Fenerbahce away, where you take your life in your own hands. So that's how flawed it is. So you've got the loyalty pot, then there's an allocation to exec, and then there's the standard pot. The success rate in the standard pot historically has been 20%. And for years and years and years, we've had to scrap around trying to pick tickets up off here, there and everywhere. And by and large, mates sort mates out. So people who pick up, people get spares. They always... But it is a bit of a charade.
It's like a job. It's like someone's got a job.
Well, it's exactly that, and it's tiresome. And you do spend as much of your week running around trying to get a ticket than you would do at work and paying your loved ones some attention. There's that side of it. But by and large, everybody ends up. What United have started to do, we started to clamp down on that for reasons to get. Ultimately, they don't want it to be a close shop. They want to make sure more people get into more games and all that kind of stuff. So they've started to clamp down on things like, if you found, in possession, if your ticket, they came up with the bully boy bit in the terms and conditions of the season ticket, which said, if I, for example, gave you my ticket to go to wherever away and that ended up getting found out, they would ban me from going, they would suspend me from being able to apply for away games, they'd take my season ticket off me, et cetera, et cetera. So you kind of got all of that. Then what they've started to do is quite randomly, instead of just getting your ticket through the post like a grown-up would get, they then started to bring in this thing where you'd go, you've got to turn up at the ticket office at Watford away, and you therefore have to produce photo ID to prove that it's you. So they started doing that randomly. Because they're trying to basically say, if we give somebody a ticket, we want you to go to that game and we want you to stand or sit in that seat and do whatever. They want control over who goes. Again, I understand all of that. What was unique about Leicester, bringing it back up, is they applied the European away thing then, which was whenever we go in a Euro away, I don't know if it's the same for Liverpool, we always have to take a voucher that the club sent to us to a designated pickup point in the city centre or in a hotel somewhere and exchange that with photo ID to prove that you've been. And it all counts towards status further down the line should United get to the end stages of cup competition. What they did with Leicester was, for the first time ever, for a domestic away, they applied the European thing where you took the voucher down and we had to turn up at Leicester Tigers. The ticket office were there on mass collection points and we had to prove that it was us that were there and picking up. Now, to be honest, it went without a hitch. You know, they were mobbed up with staff. There's no way that's going to last forever if they decided to do it every week. But, you know, it's just starting to get harder and harder and harder to kind of get into away games via normal means. And it was as much as there was no downside from doing it at the weekend, it is going to get harder and harder and harder. So, yeah, that's a bit of a whistle-stop tour of what happened.
It's this dangerous sort of, I'd say dangerous, you can do things for the very best of intentions, but real life intervenes a lot of the time on the one hand, and on the other hand, there is that things can become quite chaotic quite quickly in terms of the fact that, you know, it's difficult. And this is the problem. I mean, the whole issue is that grounds aren't big enough. All grounds aren't big enough, with the possible exception, actually, of Manchester United's. And even there, you know, Liverpool could sell United's away end out three times over, if we're all honest about it. If people knew that there was the opportunity of going, you know, Liverpool could probably get 12,000 in there. But that's not that's not viable. But what I'm saying here is that we are all in a situation where there's tons and tons of people who want to go to away games. We hear it all the time on the Anfield Wrap. And, you know, I'm lucky enough to get to go to a fair few. And I understand that I'm lucky, if you know what I mean, that we managed to box it, but the whole thing is this gap between people who feel as though the loyalty and the respect and the support they've given the football club for many years should be rewarded on one hand. On the other hand, the fact that, you know, they're there all the time singing the songs, making the noise, being the away crew that theoretically the football club should want on the other. And there's loads of hands here, because then there's people who might think, well, I'd do that. If you gave me the chance, I'd do that. I'd be there every week. I'd be doing that. I'm not saying it's easy for football clubs, but the idea of having to turn up to a set location with photo ID and not be able to pass any ticket on ever, to me, just feels as though it's an exceptionally slippery path.
Yeah, it is. I mean, there's talk about the fact that next season, if, for example, I might, if I'm successful in the ballot, I mean, and just to give you this, my strike rate, I've been to every away game for God knows how many years, bar the odd one maybe, but if I take the last 5 years, I've not missed a solitary domestic away game. I've had four tickets via proper means for that. So there's my strike rate, yeah. So there's that. I kind of understand people thinking, well, I've been going since this. But then it's like the housing ladder. At some point, someone's got to start. Someone's got to get in.
Yeah.
You know, to become loyal, you've got to get in the first place. I have a massive problem with the exclusivity, and I have a massive problem with allocations. And, you know, and I've brought this up a number of times. I've had chats with, you know, some of your Spirit Shanker guys. You know how much time I've got for Jay. I think he's a top guy, and I think they do brilliant things. But I have I had such a bigger issue. For me, the £30 away ticket, that came a stage too early. You know, you don't make something that's already massive demand cheaper until you've dealt out. When you've dealt with the demand and the supply piece, then you make it cost effective. For me, as great as that is, and it's, you know, and I'm a big, big fan of it, it just came a stage too early, because ultimately the root cause of all of these problems that every club has with ticketing, it stems from the fact that there's not enough to go around. Now, I have a very, very simple philosophy on this, you know, not just with my football head on, but my work head on as well, is that if there's a supply, then it's your job to meet that. If you've got the demand, you've got to supply that as best as you can. Now, the whole issue of, well, you know, away crowds for a start make the atmosphere, all right? Away crowds drive the home ends dry, you know, and so on and so forth.
It's a back and forth. Like, your atmosphere against Leicester was a cracker, but one of the reasons why is because Leicester themselves, they're very good, and certainly this last season, full stop, but this season for big games, the big teams come and Leicester want to make a bit of a noise and make a bit of a point.
Yeah, you know.
Which is football.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's kind of why we all started going in the first place, isn't it? But But I have a massive issue with this allocation piece. And the reality is, you know, grounds should, I don't believe football should be a closed shop. I think it should be open to all. If you want to go to watch a football match, you should be able to go. With the money in the game nowadays, right, where grounds can be made bigger, policing can be afforded, stewarding can be afforded, better facilities, whether that be more seating or putting safe standing in, we can, the game has enough revenue within it to be able to make this not as big a deal. Because of allocations, that's why touting exists. That's why, you know, listen, you may have picked up, I know me and you've had some dialogue about how a colleague of mine from United We Stand managed to gain access to the ground. And as funny as it is, ultimately people are resorting to do that. You know, there was people getting in. I've been at games this year where people are taking last year's stub. I've been there where people are gluing Stoke City stubs to the barcode of a Bournemouth stub so they can get in at West Brom. It's ridiculous. It is absolutely ridiculous. And the root cause of all of this nonsense is the fact that there aren't enough tickets to go around. The next thing that then gets brought up, well, it's already well saying that as a United fan, because it only really impacts you and it only really impacts Liverpool because of the demand. Well, that's not our problem. You know, the reality is, and I'll give you an example of this. Right? When we played Wigan in the Cup, when we give a domestic away game allocation out, you get that corner where you've all been and stood before. Yeah. And, you know that that's roughly in the 3,200, I think, the allocation for that is. If you come for a cup game, you get that, and you get the top of what is known as East Stand. We call it K Stand, the top tier of East Stand. And you get that as well. So you get that 6,000 that takes you up to the 9,000. Now, my point on this is Wigan were given an opportunity to say, do you want that allocation or do you want the lot? And Wigan said, no, we'll take the three. So they had that, and then United sold pretty much all of what was above that. So no harm done, but the club had the choice. And I'm of the view here that if you take behind the goal at Anfield, we should be given the choice of, do you want that whole away end at Anfield behind the goal, like we'd get if it was a cup game? And if you can't sell it, if you take that end, and it can't be sold, well, you're going to get charged for it. Or you have the opportunity to take 2.5 and we'll sell the rest. There should be really simple philosophies and rules within football. And I'm tired of hearing all of these idealistic things. Well, it can't be done because of safety, this, police, that. Nonsense. Absolute nonsense. There is always ways and means of getting round all of those kind of things when sensible, clued up people get round the table. But the reality is all of these issues around ticking exist because there are more people wanting to get in than they can supply. And with the amount of money in the game these days, it's pretty disgusting that that is becoming more and more and more of a close shop. And the thing that I keep pointing back to is look around at the average age now. Yeah. If you're away end at Liverpool, because if it's anything like United, it will be averaging 45 plus. The generation beneath that just can't get in.
And also,
football after us is probably dead as a spectator sport in this country, and that is really sad.
But also, if you want to do the cynical business stuff, and I think this is one of the reasons why they managed to convince them on the £30 tickets, it adds to the product. And that's the thing that I don't understand. I mean, we can't talk about this all day, although you and I can talk about this all day, but it adds to the product as far as I'm concerned. The idea of raucous away ends, full grounds with more people in, sold out. You know what I mean? That literally, it's the spectacle. It's the idea that this is meant to be a spectacle. That's what you're selling as a television thing worldwide. It's what you're selling to a million different territories. You're selling, look at the spectacle of this. The quality may not always be there, but these lads on the pitch are mental. They run themselves into the ground, and these lads on the stand, they don't have to make tons and tons of noise.
No, absolutely. Listen, go on, you know, I'm sure if you did a poll across all your listeners, right, you know, and certainly when I talk to people like you, I talk to people like Robbo, Phil, and all the lads there, and Gibbo, and when you talk about your best away days, it's never Old Trafford. You know, that's just a game you want to get in, get out of, and if you get someone on the pitch, great. But all your best away days are when you get your 7,500 at Blackburn and you've got the whole end, when you get in your whole end at Fulham and getting 5,000, when you get in the whole end at Wigan and getting 5,000.
Leads away in the cup. Leads away in the cup.
Yeah, it's a slightly different proposition for us, Leeds away.
A little bit. Not, but a little bit. But yeah, you know what I mean. Yeah. But the idea of you're trooping up to a northern ground, you get the full end. The ground's not quite, you know, that you get your 8,000, 9,000, and they're the ones you remember.
They can do it for cups. Why can't they do it for league? It's a really, really simple thing for me. And anybody with an ounce of, you know, anyone with an ounce of sense could easily deal with this. If I ran the Premier League, I could have every ground full, every single game of every week, and I could have massive allocations, and I could have a lot more money being generated in the game, a lot more local stuff. It's just not a hard thing for people to get their heads around. You know, people will put these reasons out there. They're just barriers. They're just excuses. They can be overcome. The reality is they don't want you there in a lot of these cases, and that's the really sad part. And at the minute, because the game's booming, they won't be bothered about that. But the generation after us, when we start to pack it all up and retire or die, whichever one comes earlier, you know, there won't be a generation for us to pick it up, and that's really, really sad.
OK, we've been talking for 14 minutes. United are good.
they're doing all right, but again, was that a cue for me to hurry up and get off?
No, not really. I'm having a nice time. It's a bit of a wobble since you played us. It's a bit of a funny game, that one, in that you feel as though it's took a lot out of both sides, one way or another.
That was a physical. The intensity of that game.
It's unreal. It's unreal at the minute, I think, Steve. I'll ask you this rather than do a player by player thing, where we all agree Antonio Valencia is good. I watched that game, us versus you. I've been saying this for a while. We've got Spurs this weekend. We had Chelsea at home recently. And I think that you've been going longer, and I think you've seen more aggression on the pitch. I think you've seen more bad tackles on the pitch. But the physical intensity of these games is, I've never seen the like, to be honest with you. The final whistle went at Old Trafford, and five players at the deck, but players on either sides, in terms of they were exhausted.
Yeah, pace and fitness, isn't it? It was like a Blood and Thunder Cup tie that went to extra time on a heavy pitch, you know. And yeah, I totally agree with you. I think you'd expect that with the way the game is nowadays in terms of fitness and the science and all that kind of stuff. So you do kind of expect that. But the thing is though, that Liverpool, this is what Liverpool for me have been dining out on a little bit. I'm not one of these United fans that just gets off on this slagging Liverpool off the stage, but I think you all know that. But I've not been anywhere near the opinion that Liverpool are an outstanding footballing team. What I believe in is their work rate, their work ethic, their levels of fitness is just unbelievably high, probably as high as some of the other sides that you've had that maybe are better footballing sides. And that kind of gets you by for a bit. But when the tanks start to empty and you can only keep that up for sort of 65, 70 minutes per game, it becomes a bit of a problem for you then, and I think that's kind of what you're going to. But yeah, I don't think that game did either side particularly good. In terms of our run, we're having probably 10 to 15 minutes of brilliance per game, but we're not sustaining it for like massive periods. And I keep pointing this finger at the fact that look at this big long run that United have been on since we got dismantled at Stamford Bridge in the league, you know, which is a lot of games unbeaten. But within that, we've not played, you know, you'd say Liverpool at home, albeit I maintain that that's now gone on to not be our bet, not be as good a result or as okay a result as it seemed at the time because of what you've gone on to do, you know, pretty much throughout since you've struggled. We've not really beat anybody. We're beating, you know, there's been a lot of flat track bullying that's gone on there. And we've still got to go. Because of the City game getting moved now because of the Cup final, we're probably going to have to play City in the last 3 or 4 weeks of the season. That last 3 to 4 weeks of the season's got City away. It's going to now have it's got Arsenal and Spurs away, and that's a tough running, you know. So all of those things are still to come, and I don't think that, you know, United have got the stats to say they've gone, you know, they've won what 11, drawn 6 out of the last 17 or whatever it is. But within that, you get down that and say, you know what, if we were quite critical and in the cold light of day, you'd probably say United should have won 14 and drawn 3 of them. So I actually think we've underperformed a little bit. And it's just gone under the radar. I mean, you know, how can somebody go on a 17-game unbeaten run and stay sixth? Yeah. You know, we've not even moved, you know, which suggests that ultimately everybody's beating the teams that we're beating. And when it comes to the games above that, we're not competing. And I think that's where United are at. But I think to be a bit more optimistic about it, Mourinho seems to have more control and he seems a lot more at peace with where he's at and his surroundings. You do get the sense that the starting formations and the starting 11s, that starting 11 is now starting to become from sort of 15 players, whereas I think in sort of September, October, Mourinho was trying to pick an 11 out of 20-odd, you know, and he's kind of got his head around that. So I think we've got reason to be optimistic, but I don't think people should be getting giddy about what we've just gone and done, you know?
No, well, the next thing that's going to happen as well is just before I let you go, the European stuff comes back in as well, which obviously is going to be, it becomes its own challenge with that extra game in the Europa League. You've got the round of 32, which then feeds into the last 16. But also it's a very good trophy. We got to the final of it last year. It's a trophy that Manchester United will want to win. Still in the cup as well. Still in the League Cup, in the final of that. You know what I mean? It's the at some point the league form will begin to suffer a little bit, certainly if he sees his squad getting smaller and smaller. But that's because there's literally pots to win here for Manchester United. There's, you know, from a Liverpudlian point of view watching on, there's every chance United can walk away from this season and do a Gerard Houllier treble, if we're all honest about it. Blackburn away is the fifth round of the cup, but if that happens, it's difficult to imagine being able to stick the pace that the top four race for all that bollocks will go at.
I think, if I go back to the 99 track, I just think you get into a habit of winning games and you get into a habit of this. You know, I think two games a week is okay if you're playing two games every week because it becomes habitual, the squad's kept fresh if you've got the right level of players, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think it's as big a deal as people make it out to be. There's obviously issues around this Thursday-Sunday business, which, you know, I've never really understood, but it's clearly there because the evidence suggests it's there. But I think, however, what you've got to look at here is if you'd say what is United's best route into the Champions League, which is where United financially and commercially need to be, you'd say top four or winning the Europa League. You'd probably say winning the Europa League is our best option so far, as it stands at the minute. So I think United have got no choice really but to go at that, and then see what happens and see what comes of that. Obviously, the League Cup will hopefully be boxed off in a fortnight's time, and then that's done and that's out of the way, and then it does become about just managing your fixtures. And, you know, yeah, that could get in the way, but I still maintain if I just, you know, I watched United play, I've watched them do it a number of times, getting to finals and stuff. I've always felt better when United are playing weekend, midweek, and people are getting to play at least one game every week.
Yeah.
I'd love to see Wayne Rooney playing one game every week. If it happens to be a cup game, because he's not flavour of the month in terms of starting, fine, but he's still going to clock up his 30 games. And I think that keeps pressure on performance, pressure on selection. That, for me, raises the bar. You know, and I think if you look at Liverpool's scenario, the minute that you were asked to play a couple of games, because you've had one game a week pretty much all season, the minute you were put under a bit of pressure and had to play a couple of weeks or two a week, that's when it seems to have tailed off. So I do think it becomes a bit of a habit and you just get used to that. So, yeah, I think there's a possibility of that. I wouldn't rule out the fact that it has potential to kick you on another level as well.
OK, huge thanks. By the way, Watford at home, presuming we're saying home win.
Well, I'll be saying there's a new mag out, so if anybody is happens to be passing, drop by. But we owe them one because they obviously turned us over quite handsomely at Vicarage Road earlier on in the season, and they did us 3-1. I mean, it's bad enough getting beat at Watford. You know, it's bad enough losing on the pitch, but, you know, when you're losing to fans that have Elton John lyrics that are splattered all over the stands, and then you have that hornet who winds you up as the mascot, you know, you can't wish any good on them as a football club. So, you know, I don't want United to just win 1-2-0. I want them to take them to the cleaners this weekend. So hopefully we will get a home win out of that, yeah.
Okay, a huge thanks to Steve. Let's go back and speak to everybody else about the top six picture.
Always good to speak to Steve. We didn't really get to talk much about the challenge of Watford this weekend, Rob, but that should really be... I mean, we say it all the time, but that one really should be a home banker for United this weekend. They need to be picking up 3 points there, if we're honest.
The Arsenal said that 2 weeks ago. Watford are a very strange team, aren't they?
They're crazy.
They are. And, you know, and they seem to be consistently a crazy team. And they were... Last season, you know, we went to Watford thinking it was an easy turnover. They turned us over when we were in form. Yes, it's a home win. I mean, it's a home win and probably quite a good home win. United got nicely back on track with their 3-0 win at Leicester. I'd like to say there was some hope for Watford, and I know they went to Arsenal and got that result, but I can't see anything past the home win.
And you're also in the same boat, really, for Arsenal versus Hull, although Hull have beaten Liverpool and held United, Paul. What I'm saying here is I'd be surprised if Arsenal don't get it together. I'd also be surprised if Hull managed to make it 3 good results out of 3, given these 3 fixtures. But the one thing you now know for a fact is Arsenal are going to have to absolutely fight for it right the way through the game.
Definitely. And I think that what we're finding is teams like Hull, Sunderland,
Swansea.
They're not. I think I said it before Christmas. It just depends on when you play someone. And if you play them at a time when they come into a form, like you guys found to your cost against Hull, and to a certain extent when we played Sunderland, you know, that we got a 0-0 draw, which doesn't look like a bad result after you saw what happened at Palace, you know. So I you know my thoughts on, you know, 3 times in a season, every team, all the top teams win, and, you know, someone's going to mess up. And I wouldn't be surprised if it comes in one of those two games, to be honest.
Do you think Arsenal are a bit more forewarned, though, wouldn't you, Mo?
You think so? I mean, the fact that they just had that result against Watford, and that sometimes when Arsenal are looking good, these are the kind of games they steamroll 4 or 5-0. When Arsenal aren't looking good, these are the kind of games that they can slowly get a 1-0
The idea they lose three on the bounce, I find difficult, Mo.
Yeah.
Like good sides, and they are a good side. No matter where they finish, they'll finish top six this season. They're a good side. Good sides don't lose three on the bounce.
What they've also got is a good player in Danny Welbeck coming back, another good option who's looked pretty close to his full fitness when he's come back since I've seen him recently. So, yeah, in order to almost putting more pressure on the Liverpool-Spurs game is that I think that everyone else is going to win this weekend. I honestly do.
Have they got, do you know whether Elneny's back for Arsenal?
Yes, he is, yeah.
I think that, you know, a lot of people, it's not been pointed out, they haven't really had any kind of central midfield, I think, against Chelsea. They probably had Coquelin, didn't they?
And Oxlade Chamberlain was playing there as well.
Yeah, but they're not really, that wouldn't be, ordinarily they'd play Elneny and Coquelin together.
I think Xhaka's still got one more game of suspension.
And Xhaka as well, so they'd play two of those three in most games, and they haven't had that recently, and it's shown. I think you do need to have that strength in midfield, particularly for Arsenal, who are known for having that kind of tippy-tappy mentality, you know.
Burnley versus Chelsea, Rob, is now a strange fixture in that Chelsea ever so slightly do look a bit over the hill. And that's hugely... I just sort of think that we're all in for one this weekend. It honestly wouldn't surprise me if Chelsea struggle, Burnley win, but it just basically now makes no odds in the grand scheme of things, because everyone will just go, you know, Liverpool get a result against Spurs, Arsenal drop a point, everyone ends up looking at each other going, oh, that's great, they've lost, but they've still got a 10-point gap. That's genuinely almost... For the way this season's gone for Chelsea, that's almost what's in my head as being the likely outcome, which is really weird.
Yeah, Burnley have got the greatest home record in Europe or something.
They've got a great home record.
Chelsea are walking into... Look, if there's a banana skin which Chelsea are prepared to slip on, and it seems like it has to be their choice at the moment because everything's scripted as they are writing it, this is one. But then again, you just see, you look at those results as they're coming in. I've got half an eye on them, and Burnley will have been beaten 1-0 by Chelsea, and we'll all go off.
And everyone will say, Burnley played quite well. They did all right. They had a couple of chances. They had one chance towards the end where they could have got one back, and then you never have known.
It feels a bit like Leicester last season to me all over again, you know, where we were chasing them and seemingly getting close to them. And then just as you get close to them, you know, or just when they lose or drop a point, you drop a point. I think the weekend we played Liverpool last year, we got a great result, we thought. But I think Leicester won, and it makes it look like a... I mean, how can people say... Like, if we don't win against you, people say, and Spurs drop points at Liverpool. How is that points?
That was my thing, when we went to Old Trafford and drew. Yeah. And it's like, getting a point at Old Trafford feel like you've dropped two?
Yeah.
But that's what they've done this season. They've
raised the bar. They've made us have to be completely...
Well, basically, to win every game, or you're a failure.
you do feel there is something... Which I think people are getting a little lost with Chelsea, because they go, it's the name Chelsea. Chelsea used to win the leagues, and it was only a couple of years ago. But, and this is a note of caution I would sound on their behalf almost, this is a new Chelsea with a new manager, and they have not played the way the old Chelsea played. They've got more in common with that Leicester team of last season. Now, that's not to say they're going to get relegated next season. But let's bear in mind they were a very, very poor side last season, and you know the league doesn't lie over a season in that sense. So although I do think they're going to get over the line, I do think they're going to win this league by a distance. I'm also going to claim play have my cake and eat it. I also think there is a combust in there. There has to be, because it can't be that seamless that you go through games at 7 out of 10, game after game after game.
Yeah, but
they're like a rich man's Leicester.
Don't give me the air buts, Mo, because I know what I've said is totally illogical.
I agree, but I just think that's going to come next season. Because, I mean, if you look at how they won the league last year and then the season after, it all imploded. I think that's where you start to see it. All the things that were a strength one year became a weakness, namely the fact that Jose Mourinho didn't change his team, and that suddenly became a weakness because they all got tired or mentally tired together. That could happen again, because that pattern has been repeated this season with the similar team. But I just think that, like you were saying before, even if they do slip up, they're not going to slip up significantly enough. What they've got is currently what most of the other top teams have got, which we haven't got at the moment, is one or two attacking players in good form who can produce a bit of magic when everything else isn't clicking for someone else. Man United have got Mkhitaryan, who's doing it at the moment. Chelsea have got Hazard, who's doing it at the moment. If we get someone like that, maybe out of this next game.
It's the idea that you're limping along and suddenly someone does something really good for 10 seconds and the ball's in the back of the net. And now, let's imagine, for instance, that a Liverpool player, Mane, picks the ball up on 38 minutes against Hull, it's 0-0, and he goes round three, just gets a bit of space, stretches his legs and puts it in the top corner, as we saw him do against Arsenal. Now, what you're saying is that happens and suddenly what looked like a pretty dour, 0-0, about to become 1-0 to Hull, becomes 1-0 to Liverpool in at half-time, and so everyone feels great, and you're coming out the second half, and it's 2-0, and
And maybe that's the difference between the teams who have that one talismanic player and the teams who are trying to spread it around. When you have that talismanic player, then he can do those things. Then everyone's kind of looking to him. But sometimes I felt like with Liverpool recently, everyone's kind of looking around saying, well, who's going to do it? Is it going to be you? Is it going to be you?
I don't... You know, We're in a phase where we're doing down our lads. But, I mean, Neil made me think about that Arsenal game, the first game of the season. Oh. Liverpool are struggling at Arsenal, and it's 1 minute half-time. I've gone down half-time to beat the queue, get a drink. I look up at the telly thinking, oh, I wish it was half-time already. Let's just get them in the dressing room. And Coutinho bends in a free kick from 35 yards. And you go, hang on, that's not in any script. That's changed a football match. OK, we then come out the second half and play like this team who are so beautifully melded.
No, I think Liverpool have got the players. It's just that at the minute they're out of form. That's what I was saying. It's just that at the minute, it's not that we haven't got the lads, that at the minute the lads are out of form.
But let's face it, we could do with, if I'd love to see them play a month without one of those two. Let's look at that, Chelsea. That's the key thing. I mean, I think City are the one who can go, we can pick up an injury, we can rotate our quality.
You know what? The thing that bothers me about Chelsea is the fact that I've done a lot of research on Conte, and do you realise in his first season with Juventus, he went the whole season unbeaten and won the double. You know, this is a manager that is so tactically astute, and his preparation. I know these are all cliches, but this guy's obsessed, man. You see the way he ran into the crowd with the fans. When he's got that Kloppness about him, but he's also very, very ruthless. You saw with Costa recently, he tried to step out of line. This guy just does not take no shorts, and this is what worries me, that I can't. Normally, there's some chink. I can see some light in the end of the tunnel.
He seems like a machine of a man.
Yeah, but it just seems that even if we won every game for the rest of the season, they'd still find a way.
Which makes me think that, like I said, the implosion could come next year. And they try to go to the well again. Because at the moment, he's squeezing every last bit out of that squad. And maybe there's not going to be time to regenerate it in the summer. If Costa does decide to leave, which I personally think he is going to leave, I think they're going to look to bring in someone else to be their figurehead. Maybe that doesn't work out straight away. People start doubting the wisdom of getting rid of Costa. That's maybe where it can fall apart. But
they've got
Europe next year.
Yeah, we'll worry about that then.
We'll worry about that next year. The Monday night game is really, really interesting. Which is City of Bournemouth. The reason why is because it sort of segues these parts between what's happening at the bottom of the table and obviously what's at the top, Rob. But also, it's a bit of a test, this, for City, and it's actually a little bit of a test for Bournemouth. You've seen Bournemouth get results against Liverpool, against Arsenal, against Spurs. They got a point earlier this season.
Unlucky against United, I think.
Against United, yeah. They've looked on their own patch like they're in decent nick, but then they're on a bit of a dip. It's hard for them at the minute, Bournemouth, on the one hand. On the other hand, City... great for a half against Swansea, pretty dire for 40 minutes against Swansea. Get out of jail with the late winner from the new lad who's given them a certain pep to the step. But I think it's going to tell it almost more in a sense than Liverpool versus Spurs or Man United versus Watford. Or I think if you're looking for the game when people try to write five things we learned this weekend articles, the one where we're actually probably going to learn the most is actually Bournemouth versus Manchester City on Monday night.
Yeah, I think it's a big, big game for City, this. Because... they're more than good enough to win it and should win it. And if they do, I think they'll have quietly picked up, three wins on the bounce? Maybe, is it more, three or four?
Well, if we don't win against yous, then that will take them second.
And just say Chelsea drop points at Burnley. I think people suddenly go, aye, City. City with all those players. City are the team you can suddenly see winning their next seven. So I think it's a big, big game for City, this. I fear they'll win it. But Bournemouth, not unlike Burnley, are pretty handy on their own patch.
They also need to get... They need to point Bournemouth. The sides behind them are beginning to put a little bit of pressure on. They're only 5 points off 21. They're on 26 points. They're 5 off 21, which is your current, which is what Swansea are currently on.
They have a goal in them, though. That's the one thing I think for Bournemouth's sake. Even in defeats last week, they still find the net three times at Everton. So Yeah, I can big Bournemouth up. I don't think they've got a hope. I think City are going to steamroll them.
No. It's a difficult one because at the moment, the part of Bournemouth's game that's working the least well is their defence.
Yeah.
And that's something that's against City, they could
just ship six at Goodison Park.
Yeah. I mean, exactly. Yeah. So it could go out and be really embarrassing. However, City are a team who are struggling this season to put teams away. They're having good spells, like we said, gate and goal, maybe even two, but they're not putting teams away. They're letting them back into the game. Bournemouth have been doing that. I mean, even against Everton, they almost got it back to 3-3 at one stage. So they've got used to the idea of dragging it back once the other team starts getting tired. So it just depends, really, whether or not City get far enough ahead that Bournemouth can't think they can't get back. I'm predicting a City win, but again, I think it might be a very good game and quite close.
I think City have looked a lot better since they dropped the other keeper. I think that surely must have been causing the defence problems as well. You know, that old adage, if you don't trust your keeper, that, you know, if your defence don't trust your keeper, you've got problems. And I think that was the case.
You get a bounce when you change a bad keeper, don't you? I mean, Liverpool did for a month, actually, when Karius got a bomb.
Yeah, and I think that in the last three games, I think it is, since they dropped them, their defence has looked a hell of a lot better. Mm. Although, you know, Swansea gave them a bit of a run over towards the end of the last game.
Okay, on the bottom of the table picture, I earlier on spoke to Steve Goldsmith and Robbie Scotcher, and here's both of them back to back. Steve talking about Sunderland, who won 4-0 last week. Robbie talking about Crystal Palace, who lost 4-0. It was the same game. Here they are. Joined now by Steve Goldsmith, indeed, from Wise Man Say podcast and other things as well. Steve. No one saw 4-0 at Crystal Palace coming.
No, certainly not me. Sunderland have a habit of doing this, though, honestly. The result at home to Stoke, I don't think I spoke to anybody who was a Sunderland fan who wasn't of the opinion of saying that that's it, I think we're done for. There's no spirit in the team. There's no togetherness. There's no plan. And then what a difference one game can make, because you had the feeling it wasn't just a freak result. We played Spurs as well a couple of days before the game, and in both games we played three at the back. The right kind of players have come back from the couple of lads from the African Cup of Nations. Have been like two new signings, as cliched and basic as that sounds. but they have, and suddenly for the first time in a very long time, we've found a system where every single player in the starting 11 is suited to that position. And it seems to have made a massive difference, because the performances against Spurs at home, where we drew 0-0, probably should have won that game, to be honest. And then at Crystal Palace, where we went and dispatched them, it's like watching a totally different team. But we have been here before. We went on a little run like this early on in the season, but injuries haven't helped, to be honest. And we've not been able to get a settled side for such a long time. So we're just hoping that this could finally be it. Just as you start to prepare for life in the Championship, they do this to you every season. Every single season.
What is the system that he's gone to, and you know, how, you know, specify how Kone and Ndong made a massive difference coming back into it?
Well, Ndong in the centre midfield, energy. So the system is playing three at the back, and O'Shea has been the one in the middle, just sort of the brains behind the operation, if you like.
Yeah.
Where he has Kone and he has Demir either side of them, both excellent at covering ground and closing players down. So they're kind of acting as O'Shea's legs for him. That's made us hard to beat straight away. I mean, we've kept two clean sheets in a row, which is very un-Sunderland-like in itself. The wing-backs we have, Oviedo we got from Everton, who I'll be honest, I didn't know lots about. It's just one game, so I'm not going to get too carried away, but he was man of the match at Crystal Palace. He was outstanding. Billy Jones, right back, he's 6 out of 10 every game, always will be. So, you know, you can kind of deal with that as long as other players are playing well. So Kone has obviously made the difference in the back there. Djilabodji suspended, and he's just, you know, an accident waiting to happen every game. And there's no comparison between the abilities of those two players. In centre midfield, then we have three across the midfield. And Dong's energy more than anything. I mean, the guy's only 21 or something, and he's, you know, I think he's going to be some player. He's still a bit raw and a bit rough, but he just gets all over the park, and that's needed in a centre midfield when you have somebody like because it allows somebody like Larson just to do what he does best, and that's just be a bastard, really. You know, Larson's our shithouse in midfield, is how I like to say him. And every team needs it. He disrupts the game. He's horrible. He's in the referees' ears. He's in the players' ears. And clubs don't like it. And sometimes when injuries mean that you're almost relying on him to do other things, his game really suffers from it because his legs are on the way out. And, you know, he's not the player he was. But he's doing that job plus with Cattermole not being there. And Dong's inclusion allows him to do that. Rodwell, the third one's kind of starting to hit a little bit of form, but he's just been injured again. Surprise, surprise. But we're hoping that Gibson might be able to make a difference when he comes in. But up front, he dropped Barini at Palace. Barini's been on poor for a while. He was playing Defoe and Barini up front against Spurs, and it just didn't work for Barini. Nothing he's trying at the minute's coming off. He put Januzaj in, and he allowed Januzaj to float and just have a bit of a free roll, which previously we've said, you know, it's a luxury. We don't have room for that. And people would have always chose the hard work and the industry of Barini over Januzaj, but the new system allows that a little bit. Because we've got cover in midfield, we've got an extra centre half, and it just looked symmetrical. It looked like it worked. And you don't mind Januzaj not putting as much in going back if you're going to get what you got from the Sellers Park. And that was two assists and an outstanding performance. So at the moment, historically, Sunderland would lose this game on Saturday because Southampton are out of form. We look like we're playing well. They've got a cup final. Sorry to bring that up. They've got a cup final to think about, and it seems like an ideal to play them. Interestingly, what was important for us the weekend, because of Hull and Swansea's continued resurgence as well, all season, Neil, it's looked like three teams, Sunderland, Hull, Swansea, it's looked like those three with the possibility of Palace. Suddenly, six teams now.
Massively.
We're within 2 points of 15th place, even though we're bottom of the league.
I think it's staggering, to be honest with you, Steve. It's 2 points of 15th, it's 2 points off safety, it's two-thirds of the way through the season, and it looked like everybody else was going to find a way to be over the hill and far away. You're right to mention Palace. They haven't looked good for a while, but, you know, we've all been waiting for Leicester to put a bit of a run together. Middlesbrough have got the virtue of being solid at the back. But Swansea, Hull and Sunderland all win last weekend, all put 3 points on the board. And it shows that if it's going to remain this tight, and I still think that Bournemouth are currently a football team who could very much do with winning a football match. And I think once they do that, they'll be fine. But until the next get 3 points on the board, they're going to be having a little look, I think. But, you know, you're looking at that now, Steve, and you're thinking, well, it's any one of them now. It's because when there's one, you know, if you can go into the final day and be 2 points off safety and stay up, you know what I mean? It's now in the realm of just any one game.
Absolutely. I was actually watching a documentary that one of the American broadcasting channels had done about Sunderland and about the fan base and everything, and it was just going back some of those mad relegation survivors in the last. There's been three of them, haven't there? Or last year's kind of we got over the line a little bit more comfortably in the end. But there was one of them where we were 7 points adrift from survival, and this was in April, and in 3 weeks' time we were safe in 14th.
Yeah.
So you're right. Anything can happen, and you know, I'm not so sure about Bournemouth being all right. I've said for a while there's always one team that think they're okay and just crash. Bournemouth are very much a side, when you look for them, I still think, you know, player for player, they aren't a great side. They're a very organised unit who play for the manager. If they start hitting the run of form, it could be very hard to get out of. Middlesbrough, because I watch Middlesbrough as well, they remind me a lot of the Sunderland side under Martin O'Neill when he was sacked and replaced by Paolo Di Canio, where we were quite solid at the back, unspectacular, drew a lot of games like Borough do, and I think they've been sleepwalking the way towards a relegation battle for a while because they are quite hard to beat. They are very, very organised, but they're really lacking a creative spark, and at that little bit of the mad end of the season, as you're saying, when clubs put these unlikely runs together, I'm not sure Middlesbrough could do that, to be honest. I'm not sure they've got the players to do it.
Well,
add that to the fact the manager's clearly not happy. There's something up there.
Yeah.
I mean, I was in that press conference after the Accrington Stanley Cup win, and he's not happy. He criticised the fans the week before, and then he criticised his board after the game, saying he wasn't happy with the transfer business and stuff. So.
And there's
he had that walk out last season,
and it was around this time of the season as well. It's worth pointing that out. You know what I mean? It feels like it's a bit of an emotional hothouse there. But last season it had the pressure cooker release valve of winning, whereas this season they haven't got that. And you got them in 4 games' time. I know that's a month away, but it is only 4 games because the way the fixtures get a bit more spread out. You've got 2 homes coming up: Southampton and Man City. You've got Everton away, and Everton looking a little bit of a tidy run of form at the minute as well themselves. So it is a bit of a big one this weekend, isn't it? To certainly not lose, to ensure that you're not, you know, to stay within 2 points of 17th or even 15th. It would be nice, obviously, to get all three this weekend, but I think it's very much one to capitalise on last weekend's win. Is that fair?
It would be, yeah. But as I say, we've been here so many times before. I mean, if we had this conversation 2 weeks ago, I would have been very, very pessimistic. Suddenly, you say, "Let's win this game, and we're going to be all right." And of course, as we know with Sunderland, that's never the case. I think you're right, though, because what this would do is we had a little bit of form at home this season. I mean, I haven't looked this up, but I would suggest that our home form this season might be the best it's been in a while. Where actually, we just look like a normal Premier League team at home, where we're capable of beating those mid-table sides, and we haven't been able to do that. Now, we had a little bit of a blip, with Stoke come up here, who Stoke always lose here as well, which made that one hard to take. But to be fair to Moyes, he had so many injuries, and he could barely put a team out. He's still struggling to put a team out. But we do look settled, so I'm prepared, I think, to give him the benefit of the doubt on that. And if we win this weekend, it's not just the here and now. I think that what that does is consolidates our opinion that, you know what, actually we are a decent team at home, which is important, because I don't know if you've got the fixture list up there, but our March and April running at home looks all right, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, you've got to get City out the way, and then I've got in front of me. Then you've got Burnley, and you've got West Ham to come, and then it's Bournemouth and Swansea. Your remaining ones beyond there. In there, you've also got Manchester United to deal with, which will be a relatively tough game. So Burnley feels like, you know, if there's anything, that's a 3-point home banker for Sunderland right now. Burnley at home in 5 games' time feels significant, and then Middlesbrough away in the gap there as well is going to be huge. Do you want to give me a prediction for this weekend, Steve?
Worryingly, I think we're going to win, which means we'll do anything but. I think we'll win 2-1.
2-1, always great to speak to Steve, and I'm going to go over and speak to Robbie Scotcher about Crystal Palace and how they've been absolutely dragged in. From Steve Goldsmith to Robbie Scotcher, from a 4-0 victory last weekend for Steve to a 4-0 defeat for Robbie. The same game, obviously, Crystal Palace got beat 4-0 by Sunderland, dragging them right into this relegation picture, this relegation scrap, and pulling Sunderland, Swansea and Hull all very much up there with Palace, Leicester and Middlesbrough. And Robbie, there doesn't look like there's a ton of light at the end of the tunnel. All of a sudden, is the huge concern for Palace supporters. It doesn't take much. You're one win away from safety, but it's gone on for so long now.
Yeah, I don't think we're not in a tunnel. We're in a ditch. we're absolutely. Oh, it's just not going for us. I mean, the funny thing is, it proves how stats don't mean anything. We had 21 shots. We had 9 shots target. We had 65 possession. We had 6 corners. And we didn't look like winning the game ever at any point.
And that, it was just
one of those games. Everything gets so jittery. As soon as we concede a goal, that's it. And Wayne Hennessy is just, he's got no confidence, and huge mistake for the first goal. Huge mistake. And, you know, Sunderland are a good team, and they were going into that game. When I say a good team, obviously around the teams that are down there and used to fighting for this type of thing, because they do it every season, and they've got Jermaine Defoe, and there's no pressure on them. They turned up on that day. They're like, well, Palace think they're going to win this, And yeah, it just 4-0 down at half time. I was surprised it wasn't about 6 or 7 really by the end.
Well, it's become suddenly a really defining period for Palace. I mean, there's next 5 in the Premier League, Stoke away this weekend, then it's the break with the fifth round of the Cup, and then it's Palace at home to Middlesbrough, then it's West Brom away, and then Spurs at home, which, you know, we can all shrug our shoulders about, but then it's Watford at home. And, you know, there's 3 homes there, 2 of them eminently winnable. Away games where at some point points are going to have to be picked up in 1 or 2 of these, and this feels to me like this is the these next 5 that takes you through to the end of March, the next international break. Yeah, they're the crux of the season, aren't they, Robbie?
Yeah, and after Spurs, there's Watford as well. So Watford's a winnable game. I don't know. The thing is, I can't look at any of the games. And normally, everyone's trying to sit there and work out whether 36 is the, you know, used to be 40 points. 36 points probably gets you safe. But you're like, I don't know. I don't know. Normally, I'd say we would beat Middlesbrough or West Brom, but I don't know what's going to happen.
I don't see what the way home is. That's the problem for me.
Go on, sorry.
I was going to say, the problem for me is, you're about to say the weird thing, the bad thing is, I just don't see what the way home is now for Palace, in that he's trying all sorts, he's juggling it around, but they just look like a football team who are too used to not winning football matches.
Yeah, well, the weird thing is, if we'd have carried on with Pardew, I don't think Pardew should have stayed. I think it was time for him to go. Absolutely, lost the dressing, etc. But if we'd have carried on playing that way, we'd have probably had more points by now. I know we were conceding stupidly, and he made the decision because he didn't want to go further down. But what's happened is he's made a change. He's brought in a new manager who's completely changing the way we play football, and it's just not quite working. And then you've got the whole transfer window is bizarre because everyone thinks Townsend's going because he wants to go. You know, he's been lazy in training, and all the pundits keep mentioning his name, and he's honestly been dreadful all season. Apart from pops up with a beautiful cross against Bournemouth, so, you know, that's all right. Maybe he's turning it around. We bring in new players at the back, so they're making a big deal about the fact that we haven't got a left back, we want a left-sided player. So also the players that are playing at the minute kind of go on being dropped then. It's kind of one of those, there's just so much going on and so much unrest that the disparity in wages is quite huge. Clearly the players aren't fit. But saying that, I would rather, I know this sounds a bit weird, I'd rather we got dragged right in there now and think we're kind of okay and then slowly drift in there with the last 4 games to go.
Yeah, well, there's no illusions now. I think that's the key thing, is what you're saying there. There's no illusions now. This is it. You know, this is it. This is it until the end of the campaign. You know, you've got the fixtures that you've got. You can look at them. They're written down in a list. As you said before, there's got to be the idea of how do we get from 19 points to 36 points. That's 5 wins. 5 wins and a couple of draws in there from these remaining games to do that. Which ones are we going to do that in, and how are we going to set up to do that?
Yeah, and I think right now we're the worst team in the league. Not on paper, but we're the worst team in the league the way we're playing.
It's you or Leicester?
Look at Leicester's squad, though.
Exactly,
they've still got a great squad. And the thing about Leicester is they're in the Champions League and they're still in the FA Cup. And, you know, they lose that goal behind last night to Derby, but, you know, they managed to pull it out in the end. But we're not doing that.
Yeah.
So we can see the goal, and it's like we're done.
Okay.
But, you know, Saka will be interesting. Mandana's back full training, and if you think if we get Mandana, Saka, Kabay, and Benteke, that's a completely French spine down the middle. Mandana doesn't speak good English, and that's going to be a huge thing for Saka to make a difference. They clearly get on. You know better than me what to expect with Saka. I've got no clue. I've not really watched him a lot. I mean,
he's going to pass it for you really well. He reads the game well. He'll be determined. He'll be focused. I think he'll do well. The only issue is whether or not he can come and do well in a side where there's a collective malaise. Because I thought Benteke would do well when he came in. And at the start of the season, you were saying he'd made a difference off the pitch. He pulled them all in. But there's some sort of point where I think that looking at Palace, they just look like a bunch of footballers who've all lost games together now. And they look, you know, it's that moment of, oh, this has happened again and I'm still playing next to you and you're still doing that. And it looks as though, you know, it's interesting that, for instance, a player like Ledley's in, who the Welsh setup is so fond of in terms of his character and his approach. But that it feels, it just sort of, but that's because for them, everything feels great. They move forward. Palace, to me, it just really, as was happening under Pardew, you know, and how bad 2016 is, because this isn't just a 16-17 thing. This is the back end of 2016 with the exception of the Cups. And for me, this is that's the killer, is that as an outsider looking at it, is that you can bring a couple of new faces in and I think a big win would help. But it looks to me like a bunch of players who just, you know, no matter what the manager does, and the manager's obviously going to have his own questions to answer come the end of the season if Palace go down, but, you know, he's looking at them going, well, I can't make yous not look at each other on a football pitch and think, you've let me down again.
Yeah, yeah. And I think there's this... See, Palace do well. Well, when we're the underdogs, we do well. And when we get the win behind us, we do well, which is why I'm glad that we've gone down there now. Because now we're backs against the wall. That's but there again, what we worry about on this, a lot of people said when Jedinak went, you know, that strong presence, that strong dressing room presence. Scott Dan's amazing, but I don't think the captaincy's been a good thing for him. He seems to have shrinked a little bit than he was last season. I mean, it doesn't help when you've got Wayne Hennessy behind you in goal, but yeah. Okay. I mean, but you have to laugh, don't you? I say to every time that, you know, if you we will break any record, you've got anything, you've got a long running streak of something going on, we'll help you out with it. Jack Rodwell hasn't won a game for 36 games. Comes to Palace.
Yep.
There you go, breaks his streak. And, you know, I'm just scared that we're going to break Sam Allardyce's streak of not taking a team down.
Prediction for the weekend?
I think we're going to win. I know it sounds really stupid, but I actually do think we're going to win. Zaha's back. Good bit of, I think they're going to put three at the back, play the same way they did at Bournemouth. I think the Sunderland result, if it's not a kick up the backside, then, you know, I think we'll win. I think it'll be an absolutely horrific game of football. We'll win 1-0, 2-1.
Okay, huge thank you to Robbie for taking the time. Let's get back and see what everyone else thinks of the relegation situation.
It is a relegation battle, Paul Dehaney, that suddenly got six sides in it. From nowhere, it looked as though there's three, we can see who the three are. Then it became, maybe Palace are going to get sucked in. All of a sudden now, I think we're all beyond the point where we're going, surely Leicester are just going to sort this out, and going, they've just got to sort this out. There's not this feeling that, oh, they'll just find a way to put 7 points out of nine on the board and sort it all out. They don't look like they're doing that at the minute, no matter how well they're doing in the FA Cup or anything like that. It's now 3 from 6. It's a brutal, honest situation. I don't see a change in between now and the end of the season, and right now there's 2 points from 15th to 20th.
And I think that, it's much like the top six, really. I think you're going to see different protagonists every week, you know, being putting themselves forward as the ones that are going to go down, and different that look like the ones are going to stay up. And I think we'll be changing from week to week. I think that I mentioned earlier that the fact that Swansea, Sunderland, and who was the third club that
Hull?
I mentioned? Hull. Yeah, are all kind of like hitting some form must set the alarm bells at Leicester ringing. And what's worrying for Leicester as well is that the centre-backs are just really not performing. They're conceding goals for fun. Wes Morgan looks like, you know,
He should have retired
last season, because it's not going to get any better after that, or, you know, gone back to, you know, Forest or somewhere like that and had a nice sort of easy sort of, you know, dined out on that for the rest of his life, because it's almost like a hiding to nothing. These guys, you know, Simpson, I never ever in my lifetime would think he'd win a Premier League title. You know, you could go through practically all their team and you wouldn't think that. And I think you're seeing the remnants of that now. And I'd be really, really concerned if I was a Leicester fan.
Well, it's this game this weekend, Mo, if you're Leicester, away at Swansea, it's almost in many senses it's the game that you don't want. You want a home game against someone who's... You want a home game against Burnley. You want a home game against Stoke, even. You wouldn't even necessarily want a home game against Swansea. You want a side who are going to come up who were already pretty ensconced from 8th to 12th. Instead, they've got to go to Swansea with their away record, and Swansea are absolutely flying, and if Swansea win, they go above them.
Well, this is it. Swansea have got two massive boons in their favour. One, the fact they're playing a team with a dire away record, and two, like you say, they can pull them back into the mire. I think from a Leicester perspective, I think the fact that they won it last year, and I know that people have said on and on and on about how this season there was never going to be the same, they were never going to be able to do it again, I think that's given them an excuse. I genuinely do. It's given them, people say, oh, well, of course it's going to be worse than last season. But that means, oh, well, okay, people aren't going to have a go at us if we're not trying as hard. And they thought that, okay, well, that will be just enough for mid-table. But they're just slipping and slipping and slipping. And I would say Leicester and probably Palace, they're the only teams that we're hearing about dissension within the team. With the others, we're thinking about players who are out of form, or as some of them have been managerial changes. At Leicester and at Palace, we've heard about how the players aren't getting on with each other, the players aren't getting with the manager, these kind of attitude issues. And at this time of the season, in a relegation battle, that'll kill you quicker than anything.
The other thing as well to point out, Rob, is that it's probably Leicester and Palace who, if you grab them in August, don't think they're going to be in this.
Yeah.
Hull are not going to kid themselves. They know what they're about. Swansea knew from last season that they weren't in a great place, and they've taken some action. Hull have taken some action. Sunderland employed David Moyes for a reason, and it's acknowledged from day one this is where we're going to be by game 24 of this season. Yeah. And then you're looking at Middlesbrough who've come up, and who know, maybe expect a little bit more, but not that much more. They know there's every chance they end up 15th at this stage of the season.
Stay in the division.
It's the worry for Palace and the worry for Leicester, I'd say, is that these are lads who are looking around a dressing room going, we didn't think this had happened to us.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Leicester, I felt it earlier in the season, I think Europe's the problem for them. Not the number of games, but that they thought, we're not going to win the league, as Mo says again. They gave themselves that issue, so we can park that one. Mm-hmm. But we're decent, so we'll do okay. But everything's going to Europe. Our mental energy's in Europe. So I think they approached each league game with the attitude, go, we'll win one, we'll lose one. In this league, no. You have to want to die in each game, otherwise you're going to lose them. Palace, again, that overconfidence. I mean, it can go either way for teams like this. They both have trodden a path whereby they can get goals and they can get wins and they get impressive wins. So if they can dig deep, remember who they are, they can probably get points on the board. But then again, as you say, they're in unfamiliar territory and panic can set in. Mm-hmm. I think we saw Aston Villa are a good case in point, I think, where the archetype too good to go down merchants, and then they find themselves just spiralling.
Very, very poor indeed. Borough drying up. I think that's the Borough problem, Mo, is that it was always going to be the case this season. They've got, you know, they came up last season off the basis of a strong defence, keeping it solid, keeping it tight, and nicking goals here and there. It's great in the Championship, but you come up into the Premier League, you come up against a whole new class of player, a whole new class of attacker, a whole new class of tactical systems that are looking to undo you. Mm-hmm. That said, they're a side who currently, they've got Everton this weekend, they currently need to, again, just 1-3 points on the board, and then just finding little ways to find ways just to score two goals a game.
Yeah, I think you're right there that the list I was talking about before at the beginning of the programme about teams who are relying on one player, Negredo, he's in the top five. So it's almost as if they've tried. I mean, to be fair to Karanka,
he's
given it his all to try and bring in some other players attacking quality. It just hasn't clicked for them. And they haven't really had the advantage of being at home. They haven't really seen it as a place where people can come and they will struggle. So I can see them being one of the three going down, unfortunately.
Last one on this one.
Can I just say on Middlesbrough? I mean, I saw him at close hand.
I was going to ask you about Middlesbrough and Sunderland. I was going to say on Middlesbrough and Sunderland. Last two games at Spurs.
Yeah. I mean, Sunderland, complete different paradox, really. I thought Sunderland, they knew they weren't going to be able to match us, you know, going forward, but they just did enough and maybe hoped, you know, defended doggedly and hoped they'd catch us on the break, which they didn't. They end up being 0-0. But Middlesbrough took a totally different attitude of we're just going to sit back and just hope we shut them out, which was a crazy attitude to have, because they had no shots on goal. I think they had one chance at the very end of the game, which would have been so unjust if they, you know, that can happen if you don't put teams away and they're still in the game with, you know, in injury time. But what was disappointing with Middlesbrough was, I know you said Karanka's tried, but if I'm looking at my team and I'm thinking, what's our main problem? We've probably got the best defence in the bottom half of the table, but the worst attack in probably the league. And he goes out and gets Bamford and Gested. And let's be honest, neither of those two are going to be pulling up any trees in the sense of, right, they're going to get me 10 goals between now and the end of the season. I think they probably would have been better putting that money together that they pay for them to get someone who actually puts the ball in the back of the net, because that is their problem.
Well, they were looking at Bojan, weren't they? And I thought that would have been a very, very good move for them. With Bamford, I can kind of understand it because of how good he was last year.
Been there before.
He's been a lost talent who he could regenerate himself and them at the same time. I think
Gestedt's mental.
It is. It's
bananas. It's like I'm sort of not against it in the sense of we'll bring the siege weapon on for 15 to go. I can almost see the value in a really cynical Rafa Benitez sense. But there's better siege weapons knocking around than Rudy Gestedt.
I think so, and I think it goes to show the lack of creativity within Karanka's thinking, that he's only thinking of that as an option. I worry that Middlesbrough's plan A, like you say, the way they played against Spurs and the way that they got a point away at Man City, their plan A only gets them a draw. It doesn't get them a win. Yeah. Whereas Sunderland can produce these moments of magic seemingly out of nowhere.
They've got Jermaine. You know, that is it, really. Yeah. You compare, if you put Bamford and Gestedt together, you still wouldn't get Jermaine. Well, you know, that's my point exactly. Yeah,
yeah. Jermaine's at the top of that list that I was talking about before.
Now, this guy is unbelievable, you know. You know, at his age, I think he's level on goals with Harry Kane. But, you know, what I like about him, he's clinical. Yeah. You give him a chance, he doesn't even have to do anything the whole game. He's one of those players, we'll put the ball in the back.
It's becoming quietly one of the great Indian summer careers, isn't it? Yeah. Well, you know what?
I couldn't be more happier for him.
No, me too.
Considering how good he is now, he should have actually been the Batistuta when he was 27. You know, and he was good, but not that good.
Yeah. It's too many affairs with Glamour.
I think it's a really strange thing where it is this sort of, again, you'd have said, well, he's the sort of player who loses pace, etc., etc. It's this thing as though he's just got better and better and better at finishing. Like, he's just literally got better at kicking the ball in the goal. So now it is a really weird Indian summer career, because if it's Peter Crouch and he's 6'7" and he's never had the pace to lose, you get to go, well, of course he was going to Niall Quinn as an example. Whereas Jermaine Defoe, it's absolutely unreal.
Still looks quick.
But the finish is coming out of fashion. That's what it is. Because if you look at a lot of teams who are expecting their striker to maybe move people around to get players from deep to come and score, they're just out and out finisher. You look at a lot of teams who are pressing, they'll say, oh, well, he doesn't do enough in the other side.
Yeah, first line of defence. So he's not the first line of defence.
Well, so he won't get in the team. Daniel Sturridge.
Yeah, exactly. You know? So he won't get in the team. But then you've got someone like Sunderland who all they really need is someone who can do that again and again and again and again. He produced two-thirds of their goals have come from him, either goals or assists. And I think if he keeps them up, he should be nominated for the Player of the Year.
Statue.
Honestly, a statue.
I was actually thinking, if Gerard Houllier still had Liverpool, he'd buy Jermaine Defoe.
I've wanted us to buy Jermaine Defoe every year for about 10 years.
Who's going to go down? Give me the three. But it's 24 games. That's two-thirds of the way into the season in real terms. Who's going to go down? Who's actually meeting my eye? Mo is meeting my eye. He's got the decency to go on, Mo.
Middlesbrough, Hull City, and Palace.
Okay. Rob?
It's one of Palace or Leicester, isn't it? And I think Palace are the better bet. And I think Hull I think Hull will go backwards. I was surprised that they weren't as good as I thought. It was more credit to him with his work with him, the new guy, Marco Silva.
They've just lost Abel Hernandez for a month to a hamstring tear.
The final one, I don't know. It's really tough. I'll say Sunderland.
Okay. And Paul.
Are you writing this down, by the way?
Yeah, I am, yeah.
Oh, no, okay.
I'm not saying they'll be revisited anytime soon, but I'm intrigued. This presumes how I keep my paperwork, don't you worry.
There's no chance of this coming back to
us. I'm going Middlesbrough. I'm going Bournemouth, which is a bit of a shocker.
Yeah.
I know. And I want to say Leicester, you know. But if I put Bournemouth and Leicester in there, I'm going to... Yeah, why not? Why not?
Leicester. Okay,
Leicester will make the greatest story.
Knock yourself out. Certainly if they win the Champions League as well. Huge thank you to everyone who's come on the show here. Steve Armstrong, Steve Goldsmith and Robbie Scotcher for speaking to me earlier today over the phone. Rob Gutman, Paul Dehaney, Morris Stewart. What more do you need? That's your weekend sorted.